My heart smiles as I bask in their legacies, knowing their lives have altered many destinies. In her eyes, I see my mother's poise. In her face, I glimpse my auntie's grace. In this case of deja vu, a 19th century question comes into view. In a time when Sojourner Truth asked, ain't I a woman? Today, we pose this question to new powers making bets on artificial intelligence, hope towers. The Amazonians peek through windows blocking deep blues as faces increment scars. Old burns, new urns, collecting data chronicling our past, often forgetting the deal with gender, race, and class. Again, I ask, ain't I a woman? Face by face, the answers seem uncertain. Young and old, proud icons are dismissed. Can machines ever see my queens as I view them? Can machines ever see our grandmothers as we knew them? Ida B. Wells, data science pioneer, hanging back, stacking stats on the lynching of humanity, teaching truths hidden in data, each entry and omission, a person worthy of respect. Shirley Chisholm, unbought and embossed, the first black congresswoman, but not the first to be misunderstood by machines well-versed in data-driven mistakes. Michelle Obama, unabashed and unafraid to wear her crown of history, yet her crown seems a mystery to systems unsure of her hair, a wig, a buffet, a toupee, maybe not. Are there no words for our braids and our locks? The sunny skin and relaxed hair make Oprah the first lady. Even for her face well known, some algorithms fault her, echoing sentiments that strong women are men. We laugh, celebrating the successes of our sisters with Serena smiles. No label is worthy of our beauty.
Listeners, that was the opening line for my guest for Business Edition. We chose to start this way because this is not an ordinary person. My guest is Joy Bolamwini, PhD, founder of the Algorithmic Justice League. And it's not often that you find somebody who's such a technology guru to be such an eloquent poet. Usually we are moved in one line or the other, either the arts or the sciences. So that in itself is a stereotype broken right there. But I'll tell a few things about my guest, and we'll have a chat around AI, technology, learning, and the rest of it. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having
me. What was that you just did?
So what I did is a poem called AI, Ain't I a Woman? And it's also a test of AI systems. So each of those lines, I'm referring to things that have happened with tech companies. And so when I say old burns, new urns, collecting data, chronicling our past, I'm talking about when Google Photos app labeled people who were dark-skinned gorillas. So the old burns in the new urns. So that's what it's about. And in that particular poem, I tested the faces of Oprah Winfrey, of Serena Williams, of Michelle Obama, and historic figures from the United States who are black women. So it's also a bit of a history lesson while testing AI systems. And the whole thing is a video poem.
This is incredible. I'll break that down later in the interview. But I just want to tell listeners that. So my guest's writing has been featured in publications such as Time, the New York Times, Harvard Business Review, and The Atlantic. And as the poet of code, she creates art to illuminate the impact of AI on society and advises world leaders on preventing AI harms. She's a recipient of numerous awards, including the Rhodes Scholarship, the inaugural Morals and Machines Prize, and the Technological Innovation Award for the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change. Now, in terms of degrees, many. She has a Bachelor of Arts, I think it's Georgia Tech. And then she's a Rhodes Scholar, so she went to Oxford, where she researched in education, learning, and technology. She also has a Master's in AI from MIT. She recently completed a PhD at MIT in AI as well. She's author of a book called Unmasking AI, A Mission to Protect What is Human in a World of Machines. And she is originally from Ghana.
Yes.
Joy Bolamwini. Is that a good summary of who you are?
That's a great summary. I'll have to bring you around.
Wonderful. But you're a global citizen because you've lived in Canada, US, UK.
Yeah.
But you know you're from Ghana. Your parents are from here.
Yes. So I lived here when I was 2 to 4 with my grandmother.
How did you end up in tech? Because again, it's not the area. And to be so proficient, one of the top 0.01% in that field. Was that always the path for you, or what role did your parents play in you getting into science and technology.
Yeah. So in the book, I open it with a chapter called Daughter of Art and Science. So my mother is an artist. She's mainly an oil painter. And my dad is a scientist. So he's a professor of medicinal chemistry, pharmaceutical sciences. So when I was growing up, I had computers all around me because his work involved a lot using computers to help try to figure out new drugs to help with different diseases. So as a kid, he would get computers and he would get programming books and he would want to start a side business. He never had time. I had time. So I would have all of these computers and all of these programming books. So I started playing around with that a little bit. And then I was fascinated by robotics. Mm-hmm. When I was maybe 9 years old, I was watching a TV show and I saw this robot at a place called MIT. And it was made by a young woman. And so I was really inspired to say, oh, maybe I could go to MIT. Maybe I could build robots. I didn't know there were requirements. You know, I just saw that that was a possibility. So I was really encouraged from an early age to explore both the art and the science. So everything felt possible. And then I was so lucky that my dad had computers all over our house, all over his lab. So it was very accessible to me. And then when I was in high school, I was in one of the few programs that was teaching computer science to high schoolers. And it was so small that we had three different classes all in one classroom and one teacher who would teach the different levels because there weren't that many people enrolled at the time.
So your parents lived in Canada when you were growing up.
So my dad was finishing his PhD in Canada. So I came out when he got the PhD in 1990. So I had no choice. I was already going to go down this pathway. And then they moved to the U.S. I moved to Ghana at that time. And then we reconnected in the U.S. So I mainly grew up in the U.S.
So the home environment was very critical in forming your worldview, your interest in both the arts and science. Mm. What was it like being black, female, studying in this field that typically is dominated by white males?
That's a great question. I think at first I didn't notice it as much, you know, when you're in middle school or that kind of thing. And then once you get to university, then you start looking around the classroom and it's only you or a few other faces. For me, I viewed it as a kind of interesting challenge. And so my thought wasn't, oh, I'm the only black person, or I'm the only woman, or I'm the only woman of color. It was the mindset of, what can I do with this opportunity? How can I gain the skills? And so I never felt that I couldn't do it. And I was really fortunate enough to perform really well on all of the exams. So then I had extra time to do things on the side, like my own tech businesses. So all of that gave me confidence because I saw that I could do it, and then I would work with other people as well.
I'm interested in your master's degree at Oxford, Education, Learning and Technology. What was that about?
So when I applied to Oxford for the, and I got the Rhodes Scholarship, I was at first going to do a master's in African studies. But before coming, I had lived in Zambia, and I was working with local youth and teaching them how to code. And then we were working on different tablets and things of that nature. So that experience coming right before going to Oxford, I sat in one lecture on African studies, and it was just such a gap between the kind of work I wanted to do and what they were focused on at that time. And so I told one of my friends, you know, about it, and she said, oh, they have this learning and technology course. You should see if you can apply. So it was in the first week that I switched over. And when I sat in the lecture there, I felt like, oh, I'm home. Because they were really looking at what are the opportunities technology is providing for learning all across the world. And so how can we make it more accessible? So my research ended up looking into making learning computer science accessible for more people.
Is technology such a powerful enhancer of learning? I say this with this context. There's a lot of talk about, let's get internet access. Let's give the teachers laptops. Let's give the kids tablets. Indeed, there's a government program that distributes laptops to teachers and now wants to give tablets to students. There's also a view that people of certain age, they are better off just reading books because they may misuse the technology, and we don't even have enough internet access. Just as a general overall point, is there evidence to say that, look, if you give students, high school students, access to technology in terms of gadgets or devices or whatever, they would do better? Is there evidence to prove this?
What the evidence shows is technology alone is not enough. Oh, so yeah. It can be a catalyst, but the catalyst has to be in the right environment.
Mm.
So it can be a good seed, right? But if the soil is bad, it's not going to grow. So sometimes people forget the soil piece, right? So that's how I view it. If you're going to bring in tablets, if you're going to bring in other types of technology, just having the technology alone and not knowing how to use it to support your learning goals tends not to be enough. The research tends to show if you put both together, right? A good seed in the right soil, then you can go far. So the question is, great, we're introducing the technology. How are we introducing the support so the technology is well used? You were talking about maybe children doing inappropriate things. They've done programs like the One Laptop Per Child program, right, where they learn those lessons. You know, if you just have the internet completely open, things can happen. And so putting the right guardrails there can be really helpful. So when I was working in Zambia, for example, the types of apps and the tablet we were building, the way it had internet access also had some control. So there are ways to do it. And then you can have the good seed in the right soil and it can grow properly. But if you just leave it by itself, it probably won't go as much as people hope.
Give listeners a sense of how learning has changed in, say, two decades. So I remember I was an investor in the year 2000. My first mobile phone I got, I think, in 2001. Right? And then, of course, I had a computer. I typed my dissertation. But then computing power wasn't that great if you compare 2024 to 2000.
Right.
Now there's all kinds of things. I don't even want to go through the fourth industrial revolution. But my question to you is, what in 20 years, give me one or two things that have really changed about the way technology has changed the world as far as learning is concerned.
I think the biggest one, right, is the access to resources and knowledge. So you go from having to physically go to a library, physically be in a classroom, and now you can digitally, hopefully, get the information you need. So I was actually, my dad, who's a professor, who did it the old way, right? When I would call him and I would say this, that, or the other, he would always let me know how easy I had it. He's like, oh, if we were going to do this, we had to go to the library. We had to type it by all of this stuff. And so for me, it's really thinking about the access. So now if I can get the textbooks that weren't available, and I now, depending on the soil, can compete with people in other locations. So for me to be able to learn computer science the way I did it when I was maybe 12 or 13 is because I had access to the internet. So I could go online and I could start learning, whether it was from YouTube or other resources that were available. So it also means that you're not only limited to the teachers or the education system that's around you. And so for people who are able to be self-starters and they have the time and they have the access, then it truly does give you that ability to leapfrog, because now it's not just about, was I privileged enough to have access? It's how much determination do I have?
This is the CG Business Edition. We're talking to Joy Bulamwini, originally from Ghana, global citizen now, and we're discussing many things. I describe her as clearly a technology expert. She's pretty strong in AI. She's also an advocate for the right use of AI for society. So, and she's also a poet, by the way. She has 4 degrees from different places, Georgia Tech, Oxford, MIT, where she has a PhD in AI. So we'll deal with AI in the second part of the interview. But I have a couple of things I want you to help me with. When I listen to conversations in Ghana around digital governance, I get a bit worried because, for example, Facebook, Google, to an extent, even Microsoft, right? There's a lot of information they take from us.
Mm.
And there isn't any, in my view, regulation around what they can do with it. Whereas when I watch CNN and I see the EU Congress or Europeans, they're really always talking about, why are you allowing kids to go on this website or the other? You get my point. In fact, some of these companies pay more in fines than they pay in taxes because of these breaches. I don't hear a lot of that discussion here, but people here have access to all those things. Am I missing a trick? What's going on? Are my concerns founded? Is there a certain sense in which these technology companies, even though they're doing good, are also overreaching in what they do with our information in a way that we've not been able to properly regulate?
I mean, your concerns are absolutely founded. When it comes to the tech industries, definitely thinking about the social media companies, so whether it was Twitter, now X, Facebook, now Meta, part of what happened when they first started is they said, if you regulate us, the innovation we're bringing will be stifled. And also, because what they were offering was free, some of the existing regulation that would have generally governed against monopolies and so forth didn't apply to them in the same way. So they got a bit of a free pass. And with that free pass, they did as much as they could do. They also needed business models. They had to be able to get money somehow. So if you're making it free, then the money you're going to get tends to be linked to the data you can collect. So they started collecting data about us so that they could advertise, so that they could make money. And because they were providing the service for free, they evaded the regulators. So that's how we got to the state in the first place. Then, as more people are coming online, people start seeing the ways in which social media can be abused, right? So children go on there, maybe they're being bullied. You have other situations where the wrong information is being spread online. And at this point, the companies are saying, we can self-regulate, you don't have to come in. So that's the environment we've been in for a while. And in Europe, they decided to say, okay, we're not going to let this happen. And so their regulators actually started to put in restrictions and to put in laws. So there's something called GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation. So that's probably one of the bigger ones that we have. But that's in Europe. In the U.S., it's like it is in many other places in the world, where the data is there for the taking. And unless if there are actual controls, this is part of the business models of these companies. And there's a bit of a compromise here too, because oftentimes there's a lot of pride in these tech industries. But if that's the business model for the tech industry and you start to cut into it, it might not be as successful as it's been.
How do we get African countries to move from simply being net users of technology to also net creators? So the technology first and also the content, because I have two problems. So all these companies I mentioned are either in US or China, right? Then you have the content that's on there fitted to Western or Southeast Asian audiences. So we're missing out on creating the technology, and we're also not having our work properly represented on there.
Absolutely.
What should we do? From a policy perspective, as private sector, again, what can we do as Africans?
I think that's such a great question, and something I really confronted when I was working in Ethiopia. So at the time I was working with a nonprofit, and we were working on different health issues. And I was the Western programmer developing a tool that was then being imported. So I was developing surveying tools. And then different ministries of health ended up using it. But when I got to Ethiopia, I realized the way that I built it actually didn't really work in that context. Everything from the hardware choices that I made to the way the software was built. And so it became so clear that you really need to do the in-house and the local context. That was the motivation for doing the Fulbright Fellowship in the first place, to say, okay, how do we empower, how do we train, how do we educate the people here? So by the time I was working on the Zedgy pads, at that time, they were hiring Eastern European programmers. Mm-hmm. So we set up a program to train Zambians mm-hmm. so that they could actually build the apps and the different tools that were on that tablet. So I think we really have to make that investment, right, within our own people so that we're building the technologies that make the most sense for the African context. And we've already seen it time and time again when the data that's being used in technology doesn't represent us, it doesn't work well for us. This happened also in the health field with antiretrovirals. Uh-huh. That were distributed in South Africa. They were actually based on Western biomarkers. Mm. So the medicine did not work as effectively because it was the wrong population. So we can learn from those choices and make better choices when it comes to AI. Mm. The other thing I saw that is happening is this risk of data colonization mm-hmm. and data colonialism. Mm-hmm. So as I was doing my research, which was looking at the ways in which AI systems analyze people's faces, uh-huh. I found that the systems probably not so surprisingly work better on white faces than black faces. They also work better on men than women. And when I published these results, there was actually a Chinese company in Zimbabwe at the time. And they started collecting the dark skin faces of people in Zimbabwe, you know, and equipping the government with surveillance technology. So they know that face data, just like the extraction of the wow. physical bodies mm. in prior times, you now have the extraction of wow. digital bodies to power other surveillance tools. So I think we also have to be really careful mm. within the African context to think through that type of exploitation of digital information, which is highly valuable because it's the data that's fueling the AI systems. And oftentimes the data from African continent is harder to come by. And so people will try to come and get it easily.
Mm. We're talking to Dr. Joy Bulomwini. I don't even know. It's difficult. Maybe a polymath is the right word to use. You do a lot of things, but really strong in technology. Discussing the technology space, we're looking at learning technology, but we'll also come back and talk about AI, which I can say she's an expert. A couple of quick points before we go for this break. You were named the Digital Civil Rights Award recipient by the NAACP. What's the meaning of that award, and what was the work that led to that award, just briefly?
The award comes from the Archwell Foundation. And when Prince Harry and Meghan Markle moved back to the United States, this is one of the initiatives that they did. And so because of all of the online harassment that they faced, they were saying the next phase of civil rights has to also include what's happening in the digital landscape. So they established the award, and this was their third year giving it out, and they decided to recognize wow. the work of the Algorithmic Justice League.
Which is an interesting name for a civil society organization or your private NGO, the Algorithmic Justice League.
Yes, AJL.
What is that?
So where did the name come from?
Yes.
So there are justice leagues that started in the 20th century yeah. within the United States. And mm-hmm. so you had Negro Justice League. You yeah. had justice leagues focused on women. Mm-hmm. And so I was inspired by their mantle of fighting for what's right. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, DC Comics came along, and they, inspired by the real world Justice League, created a fictional Justice yeah. League. So when I had the name Algorithmic Justice League, their lawyers actually reached out and they said people might confuse them. You wear a mask. I'm like, the mask is part of my origin story. Yeah. So that's where it came from, the real world Justice Leagues. And we, our powers are true, not superhero fictional.
Which is interesting because your book, Unmasking AI, obviously has the issue. So why unmasking AI, by the way? Why must AI be unmasked?
Yes, well, I came across the experience of learning that AI systems had problems when I was a graduate student at MIT. I was so excited. I'd finally made it to my dream school, and I'm taking my classes. I'm doing my coursework. One of my projects involved using an AI system that was meant to detect my face. But the AI system wasn't detecting my face until I literally put on a white mask over my dark skin. Wow. And so it was that experience of putting on a white mask and saying, wait, why am I coding in white face, right? I thought I'd made it. This is supposed to be the epicenter of innovation. It's MIT. So if I'm having these challenges here, maybe it's going to be impacting people in other parts of the world. So it was that mask experience that really got me going, and I had questions, and that led to the research.